pitiful floating wreckage of the police helicopter. He felt no guilt about erasing 12 men from the earth in less than 10 seconds. He turned his attention to the two Coast Guard cutters approaching the LNG tanker on opposite sides of her great hull. Before he could give the order to his Viper teams to launch missiles against the cutters, they both opened fire simultaneously with 25mm Bushmaster guns mounted on their bows. Kanai threw himself to the deck as the rounds slashed through the bridge, taking out the windows and ripping into the control console. The Viper at the helm was killed instantly. Kanai looked up through the shattered windows. The invader was less than a mile from passing under the bridge. He noticed that the bow was swinging slightly to starboard. Shot to pieces, the computerized navigation console was unable to send a course command to the rudder. He called down to the engine room. "Report damage." "Gunfire has disabled the port generator, but the engines are untouched. I have one man dead and one badly wounded." Kanai saw that the tanker was beginning to veer out of the channel toward a buoy. "The bridge controls are shot away. Helm the ship from down there. Bring her back on course 355 to port, or we'll collide with a bridge span." He crawled out on the bridge wing and peered down. A Viper leaned over the starboard railing and fired missiles point blank onto the bow of the Coast Guard cutter Timothy Firm. The first passed through the hull, exploding in the water. The other exploded against a bulwark and sent shredded steel cascading across the deck and cutting down the men manning the 25mm Bushmaster. Pieces of the gun flew in the sky like burning leaves. Then the air on the opposite side of the Mongol invader was torn apart as another missile bored into the funnel of the William Shea. It struck like a giant hammer, heeling the ship 10 degrees and sending out a huge spray of debris and a cloud of dense black smoke. But the lone Bushmaster still peppered away at the hull surrounding the Mongol invader's engine room. A second missile slammed into the Timothy Firm. Her hull trembled, and flames burst out of her stern. An instant later, another plowed into her superstructure below the bridge. She lost headway and began to fall away from the LNG tanker, afire in two places, badly crippled and drifting helplessly. Kanai had achieved the tactical advantage. There would be no further worry from surface ships. Unable to assess the harm to the Timothy Firm on the other side of the Mongol invader, but assuming the worst, Admiral Dover ordered the only officer of the Firm still standing to turn the cutter toward the nearest shore and ground her. The last throw of the dice, Dover thought grimly. Clutching the radio, he ordered in the 3 Air National Guard F-16C fighters that had assembled and were circling a few miles out to sea. He instinctively ducked as a missile from the LNG tanker flashed in front of the bridge and burst harmlessly in the water 100 yards beyond. Then he changed the frequency on his radio and said slowly, distinctly, "Blue flight, blue flight, this is Red Fleet. If you hear and understand me, attack the LNG tanker. Repeat, attack the ship. But for God's sake, don't strike the tanks containing the propane." The Blue Flight leader sent his 2 wingmen in, one 500 yards behind the other, while he circled to observe the results of the strike and follow up should his lead planes miss the target. The first pilot banked and dropped in an almost vertical dive. But a split second before he could press his fire switch, a surface-to-air missile fired from the tanker blasted his F-16 into a giant, fiery pyre. "Break off!" shouted the flight leader to the second aircraft. "Too late," broke in the pilot. "I'm locked on." He spoke no more. Another missile belched from its launcher, and his plane exploded into a second fireball. The flight leader pilot was too paralyzed with shock to launch another attack. He turned his aircraft away from the death and destruction and flew back to the National Guard field on Long Island. Dover watched the destruction of the 2 aircraft in stunned horror. Then he straightened as one of the small 35-foot Coast Guard rescue boats abruptly shot across the water at full speed in the direction of the stern of the Mongol invader. The crew, clutching their life vests, spilled over the sides as the boat's skipper gripped the helm and kept his bow on a straight, undeviating course toward the huge ship. Suicide, Dover thought wonderingly. Pure suicide. But God bless him. Small arms fire erupted from the invader and whined around the young man at the helm. Splashes seemed to cover every inch of the water around the thin fiberglass hull. The little red, white, and blue ensign flew stiff in the morning breeze. Just when it looked like the skipper was about to leap clear of the cockpit, a spray of bullets stitched him across the chest, and he fell backward onto the work deck. "They'll never stop her now," Pitt said, gazing through a pair of binoculars at the big ship, doggedly heading for Manhattan and her rendezvous with devastation. "She's about 1,000 yards from the bridge," judged Flett. "Just time enough for us to cut in, submerge, and go for her screws and rudders." From Giordino's point of view, it would be a near thing. "We'll only get one pass. Miss, and we'll never be able to circle and come at her again. Her speed is too great." The Coral Wanderer skipped over the waves like a smooth, flat stone. 200 yards off the starboard bow of the tanker, Flett eased back the throttles and switched on the ballast tank pumps. Faster than Pitt might have thought, the luxury submarine slipped beneath the surface of the water. Giordino stayed on the bridge with Flett, while Pitt dropped down to the main cabin and made his way forward to the bow and its big viewing port. Seated comfortably on a suede couch, he picked up a phone set in one armrest. "Are we connected?" he asked. "We have you on the speaker," answered Giordino. Flett read off the numbers. 150 yards and closing. "Visibility is less than 40 feet, Pitt reported. "Keep a sharp eye on the radar." He could hear the throb of the Mongol invader's engines and sense the rush of water under her keel. He peered into the green gloom and barely discerned the white foam that was sliding along her hull. And then her plates materialized out of the murk 30 feet ahead and 10 feet above. "We've got her," Pitt said sharply. Flett instantly threw the twin screws into reverse, stopping the Wanderer before she rammed the invader. "Take us down another 10 feet, Jimmy." 10 feet it is, acknowledged Flett, sending the Coral Wanderer on a course directly under the starboard side of the Mongol invader's hull. It was an eerie sight to watch the great hull sweep over the submarine. The beat of the propellers increased to the sound of a farm threshing machine. Pitt was an extension of Flett's eyes. Only he could make the split-second judgment call when the great bronze screws came into sight. He moved forward and lay down on the carpet deck with his face less than an inch from the viewing port, straining to see the magnetic explosive charge on the spar protruding from the bow of the Wanderer. "Ready, Jimmy? Say the word. You should see the starboard prop only 3 seconds after it comes into my view on the bow." Nothing more was said as the suspense deepened. Then the green curtain of water parted in a white explosion of bubbles. "Now!" Pitt yelled. Flett reacted with the speed of a lightning bolt, shoving the throttles forward until he felt a jar from the front of the boat, and then whipping them into reverse, praying that his timing was on a thin dime. Pitt could only watch, helpless, as the magnetic charge impacted against the steel plates of the hull and clung an instant before Flett went full speed into reverse. The massive propeller came like an out-of-control windmill, beating the water of the bay into foam. From the control bridge, Giordino and Flett stared as the mighty blades pounded toward them. For a brief instant, they were certain they would not pull clear in time. But in the final seconds, the Coral Wanderer leaped astern as the LNG tanker's 50-foot diameter propellers flailed past no more than 2 feet from the bow view port, rocking the submarine yacht like a tree whipped in a tornado. A brief 30 seconds later, The water calmed into the Mongol invader's wake, and the throb of the propellers began to fade. "Now is as good a time as any, Al," said Pitt, coming to his feet. Giordino held a remote control in both hands and pressed a tiny lever. A loud thud sounded, amplified by the acoustics through the water. This was followed by a pressure wave that struck the coral wanderer with the force of a 20-foot swell before sweeping over and around. The explosion had blown an 8-foot hole in the hull of the Mongol invader, below the base of the propeller shaft, shearing it apart while the rudder mounting, already damaged by the heroic suicide run by the Coast Guardsman, became jammed in a 45-degree position to port. The propeller dipped downward on a slanted angle, barely held by the outer stub of its severed shaft, while the big turbine-driven engine inside the machinery compartment abruptly tripled its RPMs and raced out of control before the chief engineer could shut it down. With the port propeller still turning at full speed and the starboard critically damaged, the bow of the ship pulled slowly, deliberately, towards Staten Island, on a reverse course that would eventually return her to sea or keep her running in circles. Omo Kanai was stunned into absolute confusion. "Get back on course!" he shouted down to the engine room. "Can't you see we've come around?" "We've lost our starboard screw from some kind of explosion," replied the chief engineer, anxiety obvious in his tone. Kanai's eyes swept the water. It was at that moment that he saw what looked like a private yacht cruising in the wake of the invader. There was a strange look to it, he thought. He was about to turn away, but then he stared with sudden understanding and anger as the yacht suddenly slipped beneath the waves. "Okay, Jimmy," Pitt said to the submarine yacht skipper. "We turned her. Now let's put those big balls of gas on the bottom." Fletch set his eyes on the radar screen and the GPS to keep his course straight toward the invader. "Where do you want to hit her?" he asked Pitt. "Below the engine room, port side of the stern. We put a charge too far forward, and the whole ship could go up, and everybody within 2 miles along with it."
"And our third and last charge?"
"Same area, but on the starboard side. If we can put a pair of big holes in her stern, she should slip under the water quickly, since she doesn't have a deep draft." The instant the water closed over the cabin roof, Flett dove at full speed and hung a sharp turn to starboard, and not a moment too soon. An audible thump rocked the luxury submarine as a missile struck the water and exploded almost where they would have been if not for Flett's quick maneuver. Pitt returned to the observation viewport in the bow and took up his vigil again. It was easier this time. Flett did not close the gap at full speed as before. They were approaching a stationary ship without having to dodge its propellers. A minute, then two, then Pitt saw the hull fill up the viewport. "We're on her, Jimmy." Flett expertly reversed the engines to slow speed and brought the sub alongside the hull no more than 6 feet away. Then he increased speed as they moved toward the section of the stern that contained the engine room machinery. In the control cabin, Giordino studied the screen of the computerized underwater radar system intently.
"Coming up in 30 feet.
Flett dutifully made a turn using the reverse thrusters until the bow and the charge on the end of the spar were pointing directly against the invader's hull plates opposite the vulnerable engine room. The magnetic charge clunked against the hull, and the luxury sub quickly backed away. When they reached a safe zone, Giordino grinned. "Once more with feeling." Then he pushed the detonator switch. Another dull boom raced through the water as the Wanderer shook off the pressure wave.
"That's a mortal blow," said Flett.
Pitt entered the control cabin from below. "Jimmy, I assume you have a safety escape chamber?" Flett nodded.
"Of course. Do you have dive gear on board?"
"There are 4 sets of suits and gear."
Pitt looked at Giordino.
"Al, what say you and I get wet?"
"I was about to suggest the same thing," Giordino said. "Better we reload the spar underwater than risk a missile down our throats."
They didn't waste a moment putting on wetsuits. they could suffer the cold water wearing only their shorts in the time it would take them to place the third charge on the end of the spar. Going through the airlock, they attached the explosive charge and were back aboard in less than 7 minutes, their bodies numb from the 65-degree water. Immediately, Flett sent the Coral Wanderer on her final attack. Before Pitt and Giordino had come up into the control cabin, he had rammed the charge against the hull and was running astern. Giordino toweled his wet body, then picked up the explosive remote before putting on his clothes. At Flett's command, he flicked the little lever, detonating the charge and blowing another huge hole in the stern of the Mongol invader. The deck in the wheelhouse gave a lurch as the second charge blew a second gaping void in the tanker's hull. The blast seemed to come from right beneath Kanai's feet. The stern superstructure shuddered from the blast. The next explosion sealed the ship's fate. Harmon Carey stepped off of the ship's outside stairway. Blood oozed from half a dozen wounds. He hung onto a navigation counter to catch his breath.
"You should have gone to the escape sub," Kanai said.
"I won't desert the ship without you."
"I'm grateful for your loyalty."
"Have you set the charges?" Carey asked.
"They're timed for 20 minutes, Kanai answered.
"We'll be lucky to be a safe distance away," said Carey, seeing the anguish of defeat on Kanai's profile.
The ship took a sudden lurch, and the deck tilted backwards.
"Are the men clear?" Kanai asked. "As far as I know, they've all left their posts for the sub."
Kanai took one last look at the panel with the explosive charge timer. The red numbers on the digital clock were ticking down toward detonation. At least the mission wasn't a total failure. Some death and damage were better than none at all, he thought perversely. Carey pushed the button for the bottom deck and hoped for the best. The elevator trembled and jerked, but descended slowly until it reached its stop at the bilge deck just above the keel. Kanai was the last man to drop through the hatch into the main passenger cabin of the escape sub. 6 men, 3 of them wounded, sat in seats opposite one another, all that remained of the entire Viper team. Above them, they could hear the Mongol invader groaning and howling from the stress as the bow lifted into the air. She was only minutes away from sliding onto the bottom stern first. Kanai was about to engage the propulsion motors when he glanced through the bubble-shaped windshield and saw a strange craft approaching out of the murky water ahead. At first he thought it might be a private yacht that had been caught up in the battle and was sinking, but then he realized it was the vessel he'd seen earlier slipping beneath the waves. As it drew closer, he could see a long metal spar sticking out from the bow. Too late, he discovered the mysterious boat's purpose. It surged forward until its metal spar rammed into the mechanism holding the escape sub to the bottom of the tanker's hull, effectively jamming the release pins. Frantically, Kanai worked the handle of the release mechanism. It failed to respond. While feverishly yanking on the release mechanism handle, Kanai stared into the green void at the sub hanging in the water. To his growing horror, he recognized the man sitting inside the large viewing port.
"Pitt!" he gasped.
He shook his fist at Pitt as the great hull above began to press the escape sub into the bottom silt. Pitt spread his lips into a wide smile that showed every tooth and waved bye-bye as Jimmy Flett moved the Coral Wanderer astern so they wouldn't be buried under the great ship too. Kanai died, never knowing that the explosive charges had failed to erupt under the monstrous propane tanks. He died not knowing that a shell fired from the 25-millimeter bow guns of the Timothy Firm had sliced through the main wire leading to the detonators. The heroic fight by the Coast Guardsmen had not been in vain. 8 hours into the Congressional Committee hearing, Curtis Merlin Zale was staring frequently at his watch and fidgeting nervously in his chair. He was not the supremely confident man who had faced Congresswoman Lauren Smith and her committee members earlier. The smug grin on his face was gone, replaced by lips pressed tightly together. Word from Omo Kanai and late-breaking reports of a disaster in New York should have reached the hearing room hours earlier. Congressman William August from Oklahoma was in the midst of questioning Zale when Sandra Delage approached Zale from behind and laid a paper on the desk. He excused himself before answering August and scanned the paper's contents. Zale was not a man easily shaken by defeat, but at this moment he looked like Napoleon after Waterloo.
"I'm sorry," he murmured to August. "Could you repeat the question?"
Lauren was tired. Late afternoon had become early evening, but she was not about to let Zaya leave the committee hearings. Not yet. Her aides had kept her informed on the operation to stop the Pacific Trojan. 2 hours later, she was alerted to the mission to stop the Mongol invader. She had heard nothing since 2 o'clock and had fought a nagging fear during the following 4 hours. At that moment, she noticed the faces in the audience suddenly stare behind her. Whispers began circulating throughout the chamber. Then a hand touched her shoulder. She turned and found herself gazing up into the face of Dirk Pitt. He was dressed in dirty jeans and a wrinkled sweatshirt. He looked exhausted.
"Dirk," she whispered, "what are you doing here?"
He didn't look at her as he answered, but stared at Zale, and spoke in a voice that carried across the room through her microphone. "We stopped the liquid natural gas tanker from blowing up New York Harbor. The ship now rests on the bottom of the sea. Please inform Mr. Zale that his entire Viper team went down with the ship, and it is now safe for Ms. Sally Morse, the CEO of Yukon Oil, to testify before your committee without fear of reprisal." He abruptly left the chamber as Lauren banged her gavel and adjourned the proceedings until the following day. The gallery went mad. Reporters surged around Zale and rushed after Lauren, but Pitt was waiting at the door and hustled her through the noisy mob, shouting questions and trying to block their path. With his arm around her waist, he managed to steer her through the gauntlet and down the steps of the Capitol to a Numa car waiting at the curb. Giardino stood by the car with the doors open. Curtis Merlin Zale sat at the table, inundated by a sea of journalists and flashing cameras. Finally, he rose unsteadily to his feet and fought his way through the turmoil. With the help of Capitol Police, he made it to the safety of his limousine. His chauffeur drove him to the mansion that housed the Washington headquarters of Cerberus. As he sat behind his desk in his luxurious office and stared out the window into the courtyard below, he weighed his future and found it ominously dark. It was inevitable that he would end up in federal prison. His wealth would surely be taken away by an avalanche of lawsuits. His loyal team of vipers was no more. He rose from behind his desk, walked to a bar, poured himself a shot of expensive aged whiskey, and sipped it as he returned to his desk and opened a side drawer. He picked up what looked like a small antique snuff box. There were 2 pills inside that he had saved in the unlikely event he would be incapacitated from an accident or suffer a debilitating disease. He took a final drink of the whiskey, placed the pills under his tongue, and relaxed in the big leather executive chair. They found Curtis Merlin Zale dead the next morning, his desk clean of papers. There was no final note expressing shame or regret. Giardino pulled the car to a stop in front of the Numa building, and Pitt went directly to Sandecker's office. Sandecker shook his hand vigorously.
"Great job, great job," he said.
Then Rudy Gunn shook Pitt's hand. "You left us with quite a mess to clean up."
"It could have been worse. We're already working out contracts with salvage companies to remove the ship. Don't want it to be a menace to navigation," said Gunn. "What about the propane?"
"The tops of the tanks are only 30 feet below the surface," explained Sandecker. "The divers shouldn't have a problem hooking up pipes and pumps to other LNG tankers to remove the gas."
"It won't be the last time we'll see the likes of Zale,"
Pitt said morbidly. It's only a matter of time before another sociopath comes along. Next, Pitt went down to the computer floor of Numa and found Jaeger sitting in a small storeroom, staring down at Egan's leather briefcase. He looked up as Pitt entered and pointed to the interior of the open case.
Good timing. It should begin filling with oil in another 30 seconds.
You have a timetable? Inquired Pitt.
The fill goes in sequence. Every inflow takes place precisely 14 hours after the last one.
Jaeger studied his watch, then began to count down.
Now, he exclaimed.
Before Pitt's eyes, the interior of the case began filling with oil, as if poured by an unseen hand.
It has to be some kind of trick.
No trick, said Jaeger, closing the lid. He led the way back to his sophisticated computer system.
Max smiled at their arrival.
Max, said Jaeger, tell Dirk about Dr. Egan's leather case.
The case is a quantum teleportation receiver, Max replied.
Pitt stared at Max.
That's not possible. Teleportation is beyond the realm of current physics.
That's what Hiram and I thought when we began our analysis, but it's a fact. The oil that appears in the case is originally placed in a chamber that measures every atom and molecule. The oil is then altered to a quantum state that is reconstructed in the receiving unit down according to the measurements from the sending chamber.
Pitt sat down, trying desperately to put the pieces together. It seems fantastic that Dr. Egan created a revolutionary dynamic engine in almost the same time span that he designed a working teleporter.
The man was a genius, said Max. No doubt about it. What makes him even more extraordinary is that he did it without an army of assistants or a huge government-sponsored laboratory.
That's true, Pitt agreed. He did it alone in a hidden lab, the location of which we've yet to ferret out. Pitt stopped by his office to clear his desk, read his mail, and answer voice messages. While he was working, his phone rang.
You were on the right track, my boy. Boomed St. Julian Perlmutter. Captain Nemo truly existed, except his true name was Cameron Amherst. He was a captain in the Royal Navy.
Not the Dakar Indian Prince?
No, replied Perlmutter. Verne met Amherst on a voyage across the Atlantic on the passenger liner Great Eastern. Amherst regaled him with stories of his desire to build a vessel capable of going anywhere beneath the oceans. He drew designs on Verne's notebook paper and described in detail the revolutionary propulsion system he had devised to power his submarine. Needless to say, Verne was enthralled. He kept up heavy correspondence with Amherst for 4 years. Then, suddenly, the letters stopped coming. Verne went on to write imaginative tales and became famous, and put Amherst from his mind. Verne owned several yachts which he sailed around Europe. It was on one of these voyages, off Denmark, that a great whale-like vessel rose out of the sea and drifted alongside Verne's sailboat. Verne, along with his son Michel, who'd accompanied him, watched as Captain Amherst rose from a forward hatch tower and hailed him, inviting the writer to come aboard. Leaving his boat in Michel's command, Verne went aboard Amherst's astounding underwater vessel.
So the Nautilus did exist. On his end of the phone, Perlmutter nodded almost reverently.
Verne learned that Amherst had secretly built his submarine in a great underwater cavern beneath the cliffs under his family estate in Scotland. When the vessel was completed, he put together a professional crew and sailed the seas for 30 years.
How long was Verne on board? Asked Pitt.
He stayed on board the Nautilus, which was the actual name given the sub by Amherst, for nearly 2 weeks. It was more than ample time for Verne to study every inch of the vessel, which he exactingly recorded in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
What finally happened to Amherst? Pitt asked.
According to an account in Verne's notebook, a mysterious messenger came to his house in 1895 and gave him a letter from Amherst. Most of the captain's crew had died, and he had intended to return to his ancestral home in Scotland, but it had been destroyed in a fire that killed his remaining relatives. In addition, the cavern where he had built the Nautilus had suffered a cave-in, so there wasn't even that to return to.
So he sailed to the mysterious island?
No, stated Perlmutter. Vern made that up. So the final resting place of Amherst and his Nautilus would not be found. Not, at least, for a long, long time. The letter went on to say that Amherst had found a similar underwater cavern on the Hudson River in New York, which would serve as the tomb for him and the Nautilus.
Pitt stiffened, unable to suppress his shout of euphoria. The Hudson River?
That's what was written in the notebook.
St. Julian?
Yes. I love you to death.
The early morning mist hung poised over the blue water of the river, just as it had nearly 1,000 years ago when the Vikings arrived. Visibility was less than 100 yards, and the fleet of small sailing yachts and power boats that usually crowded the river on summer Sundays had yet to leave their docks. The speed of the 26-foot Numa boat was kept to a meticulous 4 knots as it dragged the long, narrow yellow sensor below the water in its wake. Signals from the sensor were sent into the recording unit on the side-scan sonar, and Giordino stood and stared intently at the colored 3-dimensional display that revealed the bottom of the river and the submerged rock at the base of the palisades. There was no beach, only sand and rock that quickly dropped off once it reached the water. Kelly stood at the helm, steering cautiously and keeping her eyes darting between the shoreline to her left and the waters ahead, wary of any underwater rocks that might carve up the bottom of the boat. "Another 200 yards before we pass beneath Dad's farm," she announced. "Any readings, Al?" Pitt asked through the windshield that was propped open.
"Rocks and silt," Giordino answered briefly. "Silt and rocks."
"Keep an eye out for any indication of a rock slide." 100 yards, warned Kelly. Pitt aimed his binoculars at the top of the cliff 350 feet above and saw the roofs of Egan's house and study rising over the edge. He leaned forward in anticipation and carefully studied the face of the palisade. "I have something," he said almost casually. Giordino looked up. "Like what?" "I have what looks like man-made markings in the rock. Let's pull in the sensor and anchor the boat just offshore." "You think we should dive before finding a target?" asked Giordino. Pitt leaned back and stared up the steep palisade. "We're directly below Dr. Egan's study. If there's a hidden cavern, it has to be around here. We'll have an easier time sighting it beneath the surface by eye."
"May I come too?" Kelly asked. "I got my certification in the Bahamas."
"Let us go first. If we find something, I'll surface and wave you in." It was summer, and the Hudson River water was a brisk 72 degrees. Pitt opted for a neoprene quarter-inch wetsuit with pads on the knees and elbows. A weight belt with light weights to counteract the buoyancy of the wetsuit was clamped around his waist. He pulled on a pair of gloves, his fins and hood, before slicking the inside of his mask and pulling it over his head with the snorkel dangling. The water was as transparent as glass for 30 feet before it faded into the gloom turned green with clouds of minuscule algae. Pitt hyperventilated and curled forward, lifting his legs and using their weight air to push him downward in an effortless dive. The great jagged rocks were massed together like pieces of an ill-fitting jigsaw puzzle. Pitt and Giordino soon realized they were not in the right area, because this part of the slope disappeared toward the center of the river too gradually. They surfaced for air and decided to split the search. Pitt would head up, and Giordino would follow the rocky shore downriver. Suddenly, Pitt swam over an open stretch free of rocks. The bottom was now smooth and flat, with a channel cut through the rubble.
He sucked a cubic foot of air into his lungs before holding his breath and diving down to look for an opening through the jagged fall of rock. Al had climbed back on the boat, having found nothing of interest. Kelly was sitting on top of the cabin, her feet on the deck of the bow, staring in Pitt's direction. Expelling the last of his air, Pitt returned to the surface. He waved both arms and yelled, "I found a way inside!" Kelly and Giordino needed no further urging. In less than 3 minutes, they were stroking against the current beside him. They swam through the narrow section of the tunnel, their fins brushing against the sides and disturbing the growth into a green diaphanous cloud. Finally, just as Kelly was beginning to fear that she only had a few seconds left before opening her mouth and taking in a mouthful of water, the cavity fanned out, and she gripped Pitt's left ankle, using his momentum to propel her to the surface. Their heads came free of the water in unison. They spit out the mouthpieces of their snorkels, raised the dive masks over their heads, and found themselves in an immense cavern whose roof towered 200 feet above their heads. Pitt gazed up in wonder at the head of a serpent with bared fangs that was staring down at him, as if searching for a distant shore. On an enormous ledge 4 feet above the water's edge, 6 open wooden boats, held upright by their keels and wedged by wooden cradles, sat side by side, stern to bow. The serpent rose on the bow post of the largest boat nearest the rim of the ledge. The boats were built entirely of oak, the largest stretching more than 60 feet in length. The divers could look up at the keels and the broad, symmetrically arched hulls with their clinker-built, overlapping straight planking that was still held together with rusting iron rivets. Below the rack, where shields had once been stored, oars still protruded through small, round ports.
"They're Viking," Kelly murmured, in astonished awe. "They've been here all the time and nobody knew."
"Your father knew," said Pitt. "He knew from the Viking inscriptions that they had settled on the palisades above the Hudson River, which led him to the discovery of the tunnel leading down to the cavern from above." After removing their fins, face masks, and weight belts, they climbed a rock-chiseled stairway to the top of the ledge and mounted the boarding ramps to the upper strake of the largest ship. The ramps were sound and obviously put there by Dr. Egan. The light inside the cavern was dim, but they recognized what looked like a body wrapped in a burial shroud. On each side were smaller bundles in shrouds. Around the bodies, a treasure trove of artifacts had been literally dumped in scattered disarray. There were gilt bronzed figures of saints, a stack of illuminated manuscripts in Gospel Latin, and reliquary boxes filled with coins and silver chalices, most likely all stolen from monasteries during raids on England and Ireland. Amber necklaces, gold and silver brooches, elaborate silver and bronze necklaces and bracelets lay in piles inside elaborately carved wooden boxes. Bronze dishes and incense burners from the Orient, along with furniture, textiles, and linen, and a beautifully carved sled for the chief to be towed on in winter snow, were also lying about. "My guess is this is Bjarn Sigvitsson," said Pitt. Kelly looked sadly at the 2 smaller bundles.
"They must be his children."
Pitt motioned toward the boarding ramp. "Let's have a look at the other boats." To Kelly's horror, the adjacent boats were strewn with bones, intermingled with broken and shattered household goods. Few skeletons were intact. Pitt knelt and studied a skull with a jagged gash in the top of the cranium. There must have been a terrible massacre.
"Could they have fought among themselves?" Kelly asked.
"I don't think so," said Giordino. He removed an arrow that was embedded between the ribs of one pile of bones and held it up. "This says Indians." "It also lends credibility to the legend Marlis told us of Indians slaughtering all the Vikings in the settlement." Kelly looked at Pitt.
"Then the Norse settlement?"
"Was located on your father's farm?" Pitt finished.
He found artifacts and was influenced to launch his research project. In the gloom, he spotted a stairway hacked into the rock that led up into a tunnel. He climbed the first four steps with his hand trailing along one wall for support, when his fingers met with something that felt like an electrical switch. He touched it lightly, and the entire cavern was illuminated by bright fluorescent lights set into the rock walls. Pitt walked over to where Kelly and Giordino were searching through one of the boats. "I know another reason why your father kept this place a secret," he said slowly. Giordino stared at him. He'd known Pitt too long not to recognize when he was about to spring a revelation. Then he saw the direction in which Pitt's eyes were aimed. A long cylindrical iron vessel was moored to a dock along the far side of the cavern. The hull was covered with a thin coating of rust. The only noticeable protrusion was a small hatch tower set several feet aft of the forward bow. The vessel had not been visible in the darkened cavern interior until Pitt had turned on the lights.
"What in God's name is that?" Kelly muttered.
"That," said Pitt with a note of triumph, "is the Nautilus." At the foot of the dock, rising along the rim of the rock ledge, was a pile of stones stacked in the shape of a sarcophagus. A wooden plaque with carved letters revealed it as the final resting place of the submarine's creator. "Here lie the mortal remains of Captain Cameron Amherst, made famous by the writings of Jules Verne as the immortal Captain Nemo. May those who someday discover his tomb honor him with the respect he deserves." "My esteem of your father continues to grow," Pitt said to Kelly. "Knowing Dad built this monument with his own hands makes me proud." Giordino, who'd lagged behind after exploring a side cave, approached the dock. "I found another mystery that's been bothering me." Pitt looked at him. "Which mystery?" "If Dr. Egan had a hidden laboratory, where was the source of his electrical energy? I found it in a side cave. There are three portable generating units in there connected to enough batteries to power a small town." He pointed down at the dock and the series of electrical cables running along the edge and through the hatch of the submarine. 10 to 1, he used the interior for his laboratory.
"Now that I see the Nautilus close up," said Kelly, "it's much bigger than I imagined."
Pitt nodded in agreement. "I estimate her length at about 250 feet, with a 25-foot beam, larger than Verne described. She's close to the dimensions of the first Navy submarine with advanced hydrodynamic design that was launched in 1953. Giordino walked over to an electrical panel mounted beside a gangplank leading to the submarine's deck next to the hatch tower. He pressed a pair of switches. The interior of the vessel was instantly bathed in light. Pitt turned to Kelly and motioned down the open hatch tower. "Ladies first." The entry compartment was small. In front of them was a door that looked like it belonged in a house rather than in a submarine. Pitt turned the latch, opened it, and stepped over the threshold. Silently, they walked through an ornately furnished dining hall 15 feet in length, centered on a teakwood table with beautifully carved standing dolphins for legs. At the far end was another door that led into a library, whose shelves Pitt guessed contained more than 5,000 books. The next compartment was quite large, stretching more than 30 feet. This area, Pitt was certain, was the grand salon that Verne had described as filled with art treasures and ancient artifacts Cameron had gleaned from under the sea. But the salon was no longer a museum and gallery. Elmore Egan had transformed it into a workshop and a chemistry laboratory. The room was filled with counters holding a maze of chemical lab apparatus, a spacious workshop with compact machinery, including a lathe and a drill press, and three different computer stations with an array of printers and scanners. "So this is where one great man lived and another great man created," Giordino commented philosophically. "Let's keep going," said Pitt.
I want to see where he built his teleportation sending chamber.
They walked through another watertight bulkhead into a compartment that had once held the air tanks. These had been removed by Egan to make room for his teleportation equipment. There were two panels with dials and switches, a computer desk, and an enclosed chamber that contained the sending station. Pitt smiled when he saw the 55-gallon drum marked Super Slick. It was connected to a timing device in a series of tubes, which were themselves connected to a round receptacle on the floor. Now we know where the oil comes from that keeps filling up Egan's leather case. He saw that the timing sequence was set at 14 hours. He reset it to 10. "What are you doing?" asked Giordino curiously. "I'm sending a message to Hiram Yeager and Max." They went through the next opening into the crew's quarters. What they saw here was the most mind-boggling of all. Here is where Elmore had stored the treasures that had once adorned the main salon and library. The canvases would have filled two rooms of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Leonardo da Vinci, Titian, Raphael, Rembrandt, Vermeer, Rubens, and 30 others were stacked in rows. Sculptures from antiquity, bronze and marble, stood in closets and individual crew's cabins. And then there were the treasures that Amherst had salvaged from ancient shipwrecks, piles of gold and silver bars, boxes filled to overflowing with coins and gemstones. The value of the collection was beyond their comprehension. They spent nearly an hour combing through the great hoard before carrying on with their tour. After walking through another watertight bulkhead, they found themselves in the Nautilus's expansive engine room. The maze of pipes, tanks, and strange-looking mechanisms that Pitt and Giordino recognized as electrical generating equipment had to be a plumber's nightmare. A huge gear system with meshing steel teeth dominated the aft end of the room. While Kelly wandered about, not as fascinated by the machinery as the men, she came to a high podium-like table without a chair that held a large leather-bound book. She opened it and studied the old-fashioned scroll handwriting in brown ink. The book proved to be the chief engineer's log. The last entry was dated June 10, 1901, and read, "Close down the engine for the final time. We'll keep the generators operating for power until my demise. The Nautilus that has served me so faithfully for 40 years will now serve as my tomb. This is my last entry." It was signed Cameron Amherst. Meanwhile, Pitt and Giordino were poring over the massive engine with its distinctive 19th-century fittings, valves, and unfamiliar mechanisms, many of them cast and polished in brass. "What do you make of the design?" Giordino asked. "My best guess is that it's a combination of massive electrical energy and a rudimentary form of magnetohydrodynamics." "So Amherst created the concept 140 years before it was rediscovered. He didn't have the technology to run the seawater through a magnetic core kept at absolute zero by liquid helium. That wouldn't be produced commercially for another 60 years. So he used a kind of sodium converter. It wasn't nearly as efficient, but it was good enough for his purposes. Amherst had to compensate by relying on massive electrical energy to produce enough generating current to turn the propeller at an efficient rate of speed. Then it would seem likely that Egan used Amherst's engine as a base for his own designs. It must have proven an inspiration for him." "A phenomenal piece of work," said Giordino, appreciating the ingenuity behind the huge engine. "Especially when you realize that it propelled the Nautilus into every corner of the undersea world for 40 years. Pitt roused himself out of bed, slipped into a robe, and helped himself to a cup of coffee brewed by Sally Morse. He wanted to remain in bed for most of the morning, but Sally and Kelly were leaving. After testifying before Lawrence Congressional Committee and giving depositions to the Justice Department, Sally was warmly thanked by a grateful president and released to fly home and resume her duties as chair of Yukon Oil. When Pitt swayed sleepy-eyed into the kitchen, Sally was unloading the dishwasher.
I never thought I'd hear myself saying this, but I'm going to miss having you and Kelly underfoot.
Kelly breezed into the kitchen wearing an ivory-knit sleeveless sweater and blue cotton shorts.
I'm almost sorry to leave this museum to man's folly, she quipped.
What are your plans? Pitt asked.
I'm setting up a philanthropic foundation in Dad's name. Then I plan on donating the paintings and other art treasures to museums.
And the hoard of silver and gold?
Some of it goes to build and finance the Elmore Egan Science Laboratory, which will be run by Josh Thomas, who plans to recruit the finest young minds in the country to come on board. Most of the rest will go to charities.
Sally stepped over to Pitt, hugged him, and kissed his cheek.
Goodbye, Dirk Pitt. It was a privilege knowing you.
Kelly kissed him full on the mouth.
When will I see you again?
Not for a while. Admiral Sandecker intends to keep me busy and out of mischief for a long time.
Lauren stopped by to spend the weekend with Pitt. They enjoyed a casual dinner of pasta with spinach and prosciutto that Lauren made, trading sarcasms and little jabs between them. It was a regular routine between two people of equal wit and intellect.
Are your hearings about over? He asked.
Tuesday is the final day. From then on, the Justice Department takes the high road. My job is done.
What does Justice have in store for Zale's cronies in crime?
The Cerberus cartel members will be indicted. Every agent in the Justice Department is working overtime to build cases against the thousands of bureaucrats and elected politicians who were known to have taken bribes. The consequences of this scandal will be felt for a long time.
Pitt stared into his wine as he swirled the contents around in the glass.
So where do we go from here?
She touched his hand lightly with her fingers.
We go on as before.
You in Congress and me under the sea, he said slowly. A soft look came into her violet eyes.
I believe it was meant to be that way.
So much for my illusion of becoming a grandfather.
She pulled her hand away. It hasn't been easy competing with a ghost.
Summer.
He said the name as if he were seeing something far in the distance.
You've never quite gotten over her.
Pitt came around the table and kissed her lightly on the lips.
I have a lovely, wonderful woman, and don't appreciate her the way I should.
At that tender moment, Pitt's door buzzer sounded. His brow raised, and he turned and peered into the monitor of the video security camera. The image of a young man and young woman filled the screen. They were standing at the door beside a pile of luggage. Lauren went down to send them away as Pitt relaxed and finished the pasta. He was just taking a final sip of wine when Lauren's voice came over the intercom.
Dirk, I think you should come down.
There was something in her tone that struck him as peculiar. He dropped down the spiral staircase and walked past his collector cars to the entrance door of the hangar. Lauren was talking to the young couple. They both looked to be in their early 20s. There was a distinct presence about the man. His hair was black and wavy, and he was a good inch taller than Pitt. His build and weight seemed nearly identical to Pitt's. The eyes were also a mesmeric opaline green. He gazed more deeply at the man's face and stiffened. It was as if he was looking into a magic mirror that reflected himself when he was 25 years younger. He forced his attention from the man to the woman, and a strange tingling sensation coursed through his body, and his heart increased its beat. She was quite beautiful, tall and lithe, with long flaming red hair. She stared back at Pitt through pearl-gray eyes. Memories came flooding back, and he had to grasp the door frame to keep his knees from sagging.
Mr. Pitt, the young man spoke in a deep voice. It was a statement, not a question.
I'm Pitt.
Lauren shivered as the young man smiled a smile that she had seen so often on Pitt's lips.
My sister and I have waited a long time to meet you, 23 years to be exact.
Now that you've found me, how can I help you? Pitt asked, as if afraid of the answer.
Mother was right. We do look alike.
Your mother?
Her name was Summer Moran. Our grandfather was Frederick Moran. Pitt felt as if a vice were crushing his heart. He barely got it out. She and her father died in an underwater earthquake off Hawaii many years ago. The young woman shook her head. Mother survived, but she was critically injured. Her legs and back were crushed and her face badly disfigured. She never walked again and was confined to bed for the rest of her life.
I can't. No, I won't believe it.
The words came as if they were spoken through a veil.
Believe me, sir, said the young lady. It's true. Fortunately, grandfather left her a substantial estate, and she received wonderful care from a staff of housekeepers and nurses.
Were you and your brother born before her injuries? Asked Lauren. The woman shook her head. She gave birth to us in the hospital, a week shy of 9 months later.
You're twins? Lauren gasped, stunned at the difference in looks between them.
The young woman smiled. We're not identical. It isn't unusual for non-identical twins to differ. My brother looks like my father. I took after my mother.
She never tried to contact me? Pitt asked grievously.
Mother was sure that if you had known, you would have rushed to her side. She didn't wish you to see her pitifully broken body and disfigurement. She wanted you to remember her as she was.
Undeserved guilt and utter confusion swept over Pitt. God, if I had only known!
The memories of Hawaii came flooding back. Summer had been a breathtakingly gorgeous woman, and she still haunted his dreams.
It's not your fault, said Lauren, squeezing his arm. She felt she had a good reason for keeping the secret.
If she's still alive, where is she? Pitt demanded. I want to know.
Mother died last month, answered the young man. She was in very poor health near the end. She was buried on a hill overlooking the ocean. She willed herself to live until my sister and I graduated from college. Only then did she tell us about you. Her last wish was that we meet.
And why was that? Pitt asked, though he was sure of the answer.
I was named after Mother, said the young woman. My name is Summer, too.
The man smiled. She named me after my father. My name is also Dirk Pitt.
Pitt gathered himself together and stepped forward. He circled his arms around their shoulders and embraced them.
You must forgive me. Suddenly discovering that I have two lovely grown children comes as no small surprise.
You don't know how happy we are to finally find you, Father, said Summer, her voice on the verge of a sob.
He took them both by the hand and pulled them into the hangar. Then he stepped back and smiled broadly.
I prefer you call me Dad. We don't stand on formality around here, especially now that you've come to my home.
You don't mind if we stay here? Asked Summer innocently.
Is there a dome on the Capitol?
He helped them with their luggage and led them inside. He pointed at the big Pullman car with the letters Manhattan Limited painted in gold on the side. You have your choice of four lavishly appointed staterooms. As soon as you settle in, come upstairs. We have a lot of catching up to do.
Where did you go to school? Asked Lauren.
Summer received her master's from the Scripps Institute of Oceanography. I received mine in marine engineering from the New York Maritime College.
I suspect your mother had something to do with your curricula, said Pitt.
Yes, replied Summer. She inspired us to go into ocean science.
A wise woman, your mother.
Pitt knew full well that Summer had prepared her children to eventually work with their father.
The young people stopped and stared in astonishment at the collection of classic cars and aircraft in the hangar.
Are these all yours? Asked Summer.
For the moment, Pitt laughed, but I think I can safely say that someday they'll belong to the two of you.
Dirk gazed wonderingly at a big orange and brown car.
Is this a Duesenberg? He asked quietly.
Are you familiar with old cars?
I've loved old automobiles since I was a little boy.
My first car was a 1940 Ford convertible.
A chip off the old block, said Lauren, wiping her tears. Now Pitt was really touched by his newly found offspring.
Ever drive a Duesenberg?
Oh, no, never.
Pitt put his arm around his son and said proudly, You will, my boy. You will.
This is Ron McLarty. We hope that you've enjoyed this production of Valhalla Rising by Clive Cussler. This program was produced and directed by John McElroy and abridged by Treby Johnson. Valhalla Rising is a production of Putnam Berkeley Audio, copyright 2001, all rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.